Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we're talking about women's leadership. Our first guest works to strengthen women policymakers around the world through the organization Vital Voices. She will be followed by our second guest, who works to strengthen women's leadership in the workplace at the Women's Labor Leadership Program in Georgetown University. By the way, today I'm broadcasting live from Scott Valley in California, where connectivity sometimes drops. If I suddenly disappear, my colleague Adele Negro is standing by to step in. First up is Annie Osborne, Program Manager of Political and Civic Engagement at Vital Voices, an organization that supports women's leadership globally. In this role, she manages the Vital Voices Engage Fellowship, a one-year fellowship that provides technical skills and leadership development to the most outstanding women leaders who are policymakers and policy influencers around the globe. Annie joined Vital Voices after completing a master's degree in international relations with a focus on gender in the Middle East at the London School of Economics. Before that, she worked in democratic political fundraising for several years as the Deputy Finance Director for Martin O'Malley's Presidential Campaign and Political Action Committee. Annie holds a BA from Duke University in Public Policy with minors in Poli-Sci and Spanish. She speaks Spanish and basic Arabic. Annie is here with us today to share her wisdom and experience on women's leadership globally. Annie Osborne, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to this interview, and I'm so excited to share with our listeners the amazing work you do. And I know some of them may not yet have heard of Vital Voices. Can you start just by describing the organization Vital Voices? What is it, and what does the group do generally?
Yes, absolutely. Vital Voices is a international nonprofit organization. We're based in Washington, D.C., we empower and champion women leaders around the world, and that kind of encompasses a large array of different issue areas, which I'll talk about in a moment. But we've been around since the late 1990s. We were actually started as a State Department initiative under the Clinton administration while Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State, and Hillary Clinton kind of took this on as a project, and it was started as a way to get women involved in democracy building in kind of in Europe mostly. So it was a lot of kind of post-Soviet countries. We did some work in Northern Ireland, et cetera. And then when the Clinton administration ended, we became a nonprofit organization. And so, you know, now we've been working for over 20 years, and we've amplified and invested in more than 18,000 women leaders from 182 countries and territories, which is really exciting. So our approach is that, you know, we search for women leaders with daring visions for change all over the world. We're a completely global organization. And then we partner with them to make those visions a reality. And we really believe that sustainable change happens from within. So we invest in women with local solutions that are proven to drive change, and we offer these women the support, training, resources they need to scale that change. So rather than kind of, you know, coming in with our worldviews to a community to tell them what they need, we really work with the women who are in that community, who are doing this work and who are on the ground creating change, and we, you know, amplify her and provide her with any sort of skills training or mentorship or networking that she may need. So, as I mentioned, we work with women in a couple different issue areas, including economic empowerment. So in that space, we work with women entrepreneurs and business owners to help them grow their businesses or scale their visions. We also work with women who are human rights activists, so working to end gender-based violence or trafficking in their communities. And then finally, which is what I work on, is political and civic engagement. So we work with women who are political and government leaders or policymakers to try and, you know, increase the number of, you know, the share of global women's participation in politics, but also to really kind of create that policy change that we know that is needed in the world.
That is so incredibly exciting. I thank you for your important and vital work.
Thank you.
So, you know, we've had the sense that if women would get more involved in politics with greater leadership, it could really change things. I was just reading in the New York Times this past Sunday about Finland, and a couple had moved from Brooklyn, New York, to Finland with their two young children, and were just amazed at, you know, free childcare, free education through college, universal health care that was very affordable. And then I find out Finland is run really by, there's a whole group of women running Finland. So I just would like your take on it, and why, you know, is it true that having women in politics does change the content or the approaches and policies that are in place, and you know, do they really make a difference, or is it just kind of having women in suits like men?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important. And thank you for raising that question. And I was so excited to see the news from Finland this week about, you know, they have this new government, as you mentioned, that's run entirely, almost entirely by women who are under the age of 35. I think that's really kind of a marker of hopefully where the world is going. And, you know, the Nordic countries really kind of raise the bar on all of the gender equality metrics across the scale, whether it's political or, you know, economic empowerment, et cetera. But I think we've found, I mean, even here in the United States, we found that having more women in political office, specifically in Congress, there was some research done that showed that women in Congress pass more legislation than their male counterparts, that they're more likely to work across the aisle, that they typically get more funding for their constituencies, and they also pass more legislation that is beneficial to women. So because, you know, obviously coming from their place of lived experience, you know, they understand the kind of importance of legislation on family leave or violence against women, et cetera. And, you know, I can't really comment on why that is. I'm not saying that, you know, women are inherently more hardworking or anything like that, but there's a really interesting book called Gendered Vulnerability by Jeffrey Lazarus and Amy Siegelwalt that came out, I think, a year or two ago. But this is about women in Congress. And their hypothesis and thesis that they did research on was that women feel more vulnerable to losing their next re-election campaign. I think for good reason. Obviously, women, you know, are more likely to be challenged. And there's been research done that shows that women who are running for re-election are more likely to be challenged than men who, you know, a lot of times will just kind of coast to re-election. Women also get, you know, less media coverage, and the media coverage they do get is frequently, you know, commenting on their appearance or their personal life versus the substance of their work. So there are a lot of reasons why they might feel that they are more vulnerable. And so their hypothesis is that they have to work harder because they're worried about losing re-election. So this is why they're passing these bills. So, you know, who knows? There are some different hypotheses out there, but I think that beyond just simply having more women in office for equality's sake, we're seeing that, you know, these women are actually passing legislation at a higher rate, that they are taking into account their lived experiences. And also when you have, you know, just beyond just women as a whole, when you have women of color, women from the LGBTQ community, et cetera, they're representing the needs of their communities in office. And that is really kind of beneficial to their constituencies and to all of us who are benefiting from those policies.
Yeah, you know, that, well, maybe true, women are feeling like they need to work harder. I remember I was in one of the first classes of women at Yale, and I just read a book about the early women that were allowed into Yale, and they talked about that the women actually outperformed the men academically, even. And I think part of it was the sense of, we felt like you know, we're representing all women, and we have to do a good job here. You know, and it's been a struggle here. I've been involved in politics and government in the U.S. for decades, and it's been a long struggle to get more women in political leadership at all levels. We now have about 20% of the seats in Congress as women. What does it look like for women globally? I know you mentioned Finland now being run by pretty much all women. The Nordic countries are obviously like way ahead of the rest of the world, including the U.S. But what is the picture like? Are women rising politically around the world, or is it only in certain regions, or what are you seeing as the whole?
Yeah, absolutely. The U.S., I think, as you mentioned, it's about 23% of women in parliament. We're actually ranked 77th in the world, which in terms of percent of women in national parliaments, which is behind most developed countries. It's also behind countries with a fraction of the U.S. GDP, such as Uganda. It's behind conflict zones such as Iraq and Afghanistan, et cetera. So the U.S. really is not doing very well on this metric. The global average is, I think it's not that much higher than that, but there are some countries and regions that are doing a lot better. You know, I mentioned we've talked about the Nordic countries, and actually there's been some countries in Africa that are doing really well. So, for example, Rwanda is always pointed to as a kind of the standard bearer, which is interesting. A lot of people don't know that, but they have, I think, over 60% of women in parliament. And I think really what is the differentiator is the United States does not have any form of quota law or affirmative action mandating, you know, a certain percentage of seats for women. So, and we're actually we're in the minority in that. Most countries in the world have some sort of quota, and there are a lot of different forms that quotas can take. So some of them are legislated and they're mandatory. For example, I think in Pakistan and India, I believe there are specific reserved seats for women in parliament. So, you know, these seats have to be filled by a woman, whereas in a lot of other countries, there are kind of voluntary quotas for that political parties are supposed to abide by. So, you know, they're supposed to have, 40% women in the list that they present for election. You know, being voluntary, that creates its own problems because there's not really any there's not any accountability. But just having that in place and having that talked about really makes a difference because it's really kind of all about shifting culture and shifting norms around who you think of as political leadership. And quotas are kind of the main way that research has shown is the way to get towards equality. And I think, you know, in the United States, this hasn't really been a conversation. And it's something that I think could be, you know, at a national level would be very, very difficult to pass and to implement. But at a local level, you know, I think there has been some movement on this, and I think it's something that is really worth advocating for because it has been shown to really make a difference.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Now, you are doing some work to address the lack of women in political leadership globally. What are the specific actions you're taking to try and uplift women in politics and government around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So at Vital Voices, we have a program which is called VV Engage, and that is the main fellowship that our political team runs. And this fellowship is kind of informed by the belief that, you know, having women in public life, elected to political office, shaping civic discourses, et cetera, is really the most powerful way to transform societies, to implement better policy, and to provide a new generation of role models for women and girls. So seeing the challenges that women in political office face, and we, you know, when we were creating this program, we talked to many of the women political leaders in the Vital Voices Network, as well as as well as others from around the world to really understand, okay, as a political leader in your community, what are the barriers that you face? What are the things that you need? You know, how much time would you be able to dedicate to a program like this, et cetera? So we really tried to inform the work that we're doing with the opinions and the kind of beliefs of the women that we will be working with. And so some of these challenges, such as, you know, being denied access to resources and to networks in your political parties, or experiencing online and physical violence, you know, the lack of media attention, the personal life under scrutiny, et cetera, we came to understand that, you know, a lot of these, the women in politics globally, don't have any sort of network of peers, because either they're the first one or they're the only one in their position, and they don't have, you know, they feel like they're really going through this alone. So what we did is we created a fellowship that is a global program, and each year we have about 20 to 25 women who take part, and it's a year-long fellowship that combines virtual and in-person programming. And the participants include elected officials, government officials, political party leaders, civil society leaders, who are all working in some way, shape, or form on policy change and policy advocacy. So we have kind of three approaches that we've found to really kind of change their mindsets and have a really big impact on their kind of approach to political leadership. One is community building. So, like I said, they feel like they're alone in their positions, and they also feel like, even if they do have peers in their government or whatever it might be, that, you know, given that you're working with them every day, politics is kind of a vicious business, they don't feel like they can be vulnerable with them. So with this group, we bring them together, and it's people from all around the world who, you know, they don't work together, they don't know each other, and we create a space where they can kind of be really vulnerable and share the challenges that they've been going through. And kind of the most powerful thing I think that we've seen from this is people just saying, you know, I feel like after the end of this week, they're saying, I'm not alone, and I've never felt like this before, but I feel like I now have this community of people that all understand what I'm going through and that can help me and can share advice and can share best practices and all of that and can inspire you. So that's a really big part of it, the community building. The second part is capacity building. So we do training on skills such as, you know, gender mainstreaming, fundraising, public speaking. We do a lot of work with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, so working with them on how they can integrate the SDGs into their daily work. And again, all of that is informed by a needs assessment that we do to understand what it is that they really want to focus on and what skills they feel they need to be successful in their role. And then the third aspect is mentorship. So that is also an incredibly important aspect of this that we've learned from the women. They really, really value. So we have a partnership with the Council of Women World Leaders, which was started by Laura Listwood, and it's the only network of current and former female heads of state in the world. So it's this super high-powered women. And what we do is, for each of our in-person gatherings, we'll bring one or two former heads of state to come and mentor our fellows for the week. And they'll share with them any sort of, you know, topics they want to talk about. So whether it's, you know, online harassment and social media, or negotiations and how they handled that, et cetera. But that has been so, so powerful, because it's, you know, these former presidents and former prime ministers are sitting down with our fellows and just talking with them, so they can see that, okay, these are real people. These are, you know, if they can do this, I can do this too. So there's the saying, you know, you can't be what you can't see, and I think that has really that's really been powerful for them. So some of the former presidents that we've had work with them are, you know, Jenny Shipley from New Zealand, or Dalia Grybauskaitė from Lithuania, or Laura Chinchilla from Costa Rica, and they'll just come and spend time with them, and that's really powerful. So those kind of three aspects together, hopefully, you know, both boost their skills, but also creates more of a resolve to stay with, you know, to stay with the political career, to go to the next level, to help other women come up with you, to empower young girls to be in politics, et cetera.
That's great. Well, that must be really exciting to be in the room when you've got the former women leaders, heads of state, meeting yes. with the upcoming women to talk about, here's how I dealt with that situation. I would imagine just seeing a woman who was a president, a leader of the country, is really inspirational because most women haven't had that experience. I mean, we haven't had that experience in the United States yet. So right, I would exactly. imagine that right there is just inspiring for your women.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm wondering if you've noticed in the time that you've been working with women politically around the world, are there certain factors that help women succeed, you know, across the board, or is that something that's very country specific?
That's a good question. I think it is relatively country specific, but I think probably the most important part is having a supportive family or partner, if they choose to have a partner. And I think that is something that, you know, people don't really talk about as a career, you know, as a career choice of who you choose as a partner or if you choose a partner, et cetera. But I think that's something that has been really, you know, powerful for women that do have a supportive family and have a support network. And I think, you know, with women that have had that are from countries that have more of a tradition of women political leaders, you know, they said that it's been so much easier for them because they don't have to be the first. It was interesting. So Laura Chinchilla, who was the former president of Costa Rica, was with us about a month ago when we were doing an in-person program, and she said, you know, I love this quote. She said, "When a woman enters into politics, that woman changes. But when many women enter into politics, it is politics that changes." So you can kind of see that with you know, in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, I think a lot of people talk about her as kind of the paragon of new forms of political leadership. And I think she's an incredible leader, so empathetic, collaborative, open, and she's really broken barriers and is really unapologetic in her leadership, which is amazing. But she, you know, she's the third female prime minister in New Zealand. And so having the luxury to not be the first means that you can just really kind of keep pushing and keep normalizing this. There was another story that Laura Chinchilla said to us when, because she was the first female president of Costa Rica. And she was talking to, I think she was meeting with a school. And, you know, she asked a little boy, you know, would he want to be president someday? And he said, "Oh, but I thought only girls can be president," because he didn't know anything else at that point. So when you have women who are in these leadership, really visible leadership positions, that totally changes the game for everyone who's coming behind them. It makes it so much easier. Not that it's ever easy, but it just makes it a little bit easier for them to really kind of rise up, because it's about that culture and the norms around leadership.
Yeah, and it's so great that these women who have served as heads of state are willing to help the other women coming behind them.
Yeah.
You know, I just love that whole collaborative model that you build on. And you've talked about quite a number of the women have come through this fellowship program. Can you give us an example of, you know, a woman that's come through the program and who she is and where she was when she came in, and then kind of what she learned through the program and how she grew and what she's doing now, kind of like a case study from
sure.
the fellowship program?
Absolutely. One example that comes to mind is a woman named Yasmin Halal from Egypt. She was in the program last year, and she started an education organization in Egypt, where she's from. And this organization is kind of about, you know, student-centered learning. It's very kind of, it's not kind of your traditional, like, just test-based learning. It's really kind of focused on the holistic, the whole student, and developing their, you know, their leadership and their knowledge. And she's done, you know, an amazing job building this model in Egypt. And when she came to, last year we had our first impact person gathering in Florence, Italy. And when she came to Florence, she was telling us how she had actually just been approached to become an advisor to the Minister of Education in Egypt. But she wasn't sure if she was going to do it because she had a, you know, she has a young child that she was parenting, and this, you know, her organization was taking up more than it should have of her time. So she didn't feel like she necessarily had the time to do it. And, you know, when we were in Florence, we did a lot of kind of leadership development work. So having them explore their personal driving force, what other kind of practices of leadership we've identified as really successful for women leaders. And then we also do work on, you know, on communications and political leadership and personal branding and networking and all those things. But she came away from that, and she wrote to us afterwards and said, you know, I really just kind of made the decision of my life. I made the realization of my life that, you know, this is something that this opportunity to become an advisor to the Minister of Education means I can create this systemic change rather than just working in my organization and creating change there. Like, I could create change throughout the entire education system in Egypt. And also being in a room with, you know, with former presidents and with these other women who are doing really courageous things, she was saying, you know, that's a dose of courage. It's kind of like a slap in the face that you know, don't be afraid. Oh, you'll make it work. Even though you have all these other commitments, you can make it work. And so she decided to take on that job and is now doing both things. So running her nonprofit and she's an advisor to the Minister of Education. So I think that's a good example of just kind of, you know, it's the skills, but it's also just kind of the courage and the compassion and the vulnerability and all those things that come when you're in this room with all these incredible women and really just kind of focusing on you and your personal leadership for those couple of days. It's very, very powerful.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. I'm at a gathering right now, and the wonderful Lynn Twist is here. She had a great expression the other day talking about our job now is to lift the veils of discouragement from the eyes and hearts mm-hmm. of people so we
Absolutely.
Can be encouraged to be who we are and do what needs to be done in the world right now and create that new world. So yeah. Thank you for giving all these women courage. Do you allow American women into the program? Is this all other
we
countries?
We do. No, we are completely global. So this year we have one American fellow, a woman named Rebecca Warren, who is a state legislator in Michigan. And last year we had a young woman, Brooke Lopez, who's working to kind of amplify Latino women in Texas politics. So, yeah, we usually have you know, at least one American woman per year.
Well, that's nice. I'm glad we're still included in the mix there.
And we have our own, you know, we definitely acknowledge that the U.S. is not immune to the problems that the rest of the world faces.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. I've been very interested since coming along. You know, I came of age during the modern women's movement, and the mm-hmm. idea was it would not be just add women and stir, but actually women would come in and do the systemic change that you're talking mm-hmm. about. And that includes also the very notion of leadership itself. And the traditional model of leadership, particularly in politics, has often been yeah. kind of authoritarian, command, mm-hmm. you know, top-down, directive. But the idea was that women would come along and listen better and be more collaborative. Were we dreaming, or do women actually bring a new leadership style into government?
I think that they do, and I think that it's not something, again, kind of like I was saying earlier, it's not something that, you know, is inherent to women. It's not anything genetic or anything, but it's something that is related to, you know, the way that women are socialized and the culture. But we have really seen that traditional styles of leadership, the hierarchical, exclusive, that feel very kind of masculine, those are really kind of shifting to now, you know, collaborative, inclusive, women who are seeking power to empower others. And it's not just women, you know, it's male leaders as well. I think that has kind of caught on a little bit as the new way of leadership. And I think that women have kind of pioneered that. And I'm glad that men are catching on, because I think it's a better way to lead. It's bringing people along with you rather than excluding people and kind of seeking power for yourself.
Yeah, that's very encouraging to hear. And for our listeners who want to learn more about your work, like how do they find out, do you have a website, or what should people do to learn more?
Yeah, absolutely. Our website is just www.vitalvoices.org. And that has all of our programs. Like I said, the one that we were talking about is just one out of many that we run. It has information about the women in our network. And we also, the way that we find a lot of the women that we work with is through an application process. So we do have a page on the website as well for applications open now, so that people can, if they want to apply to any of our fellowships or programs, they can see what's open there. So we definitely encourage people to check out vitalvoices.org if you are interested in learning more.
Well, that's all the time we have. Annie Osborne of Vital Voices, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to chat with you.
Stay tuned for our next guest.
It is an exciting new program to train women as leaders.